It is Your Money, and welcome to this week's edition. My name is Susie Jones. Today we are going to talk about why saving is a critical habit to cultivate early in life and through retirement. And if you're just joining us, you know that this show is hosted by me, but our weekly guests are Bruce Helmer, the founder of Wealth Enhancement and financial advisor, and Peg Webb, who is a senior financial advisor. So welcome to both of you. Great topic. I know it's one you talk about compound interest, don't you, Peg? But I'll say hello and welcome to the program.
Yes. Good morning, Susie. Good morning, Bruce.
Hi, Peg. Hello, Susie Jones. Hello, listeners. And we do want to talk about the habit of saving and investing. And, Peg, a lot of our listeners might already be thinking, well, I'm way down that road. I'm 40 something, I'm 50 something, I'm 60 something. But some of these things we're going to talk about today, Peg, are still good lessons for anybody. Plus, listeners, you may have kids or grandkids that you can share some of this advice and wisdom with. So I think it is a good topic. But Peg, before we dive into it, on the show last week, late in the show, we had a really good question on ETFs, exchange-traded funds, and we covered it a little bit, but I know there were some things after the show was over that we had some feedback or some things that we thought of that we might have missed. Maybe just take it from beginning to end, cover maybe the things that we did cover and review it, but also maybe some of the things that we didn't get to, because I don't think we did the question justice late in the show last week. Peg?
Yes, I love that, Bruce. And so when you have mutual funds and you have ETFs, they're independently different. And we brought up a couple really highlighted points. And one is that mutual funds, if you own a mutual fund and you want to sell some shares, if at 9 o'clock in the morning I sell some shares and Richard, thank you, Richard, for calling us during the week and saying, hey, I've got one more that you didn't mention. So thank you, Richard, for reaching out. But at the end of the day, if I sold at 9 o'clock and let's say Richard sold at noon, we're going to get the end of the day share price. So all day long, it doesn't matter when we call in to sell some shares, we're going to get the end of the day. With exchange-traded funds, which is the symbol is ETF, we use that often, but they trade intraday. So what that means at 9 o'clock, if I called in and wanted to sell some shares, I'm going to get the 9 o'clock price where Richard calls in at noon and he's going to get the noon price. We're not waiting till the end of the day and not know what the value of that sale will be. So that's a major difference. The other one is that with mutual funds, and mutual funds are 100 years old, believe it or not, but there's actually a fund manager who's kind of making decisions on how to allocate that fund, like how much of what should we buy. Many of you know that some of these mutual funds, they have a preference of, it could be stocks, it could be bonds. I mean, there's just a plethora of mutual funds out there. But with mutual funds, there's usually somebody, a money manager, making decisions on what to buy on your behalf in that pool of mutual funds. With ETFs, it's usually a passive investment. So let's take the S&P 500. If you take the S&P 500, ETFs will track that S&P 500. But it's kind of passive. There isn't somebody behind that desk actively managing it or watching it every day. Then the other one we brought up last week was the ongoing management of that fund with mutual funds. So that actually creates higher internal fees. And when I say internal fees, I mean those are not what you're paying your advisor or paying someone else. The higher fees are because it's a higher cost to have actual people managing that fund. With an ETF, the fees are lower because it's passive. There's not a lot of activity. There a lot of times they're just trying to match a mutual fund like the S&P 500. But the big one that Richard brought up, and I can't even believe I didn't mention it because taxes matter and everything you do, is that if you want to redeem some shares in a mutual fund, and I sold those shares at 9 o'clock, well, at the end of the year, they're going to take all the activity in that mutual fund, and whether I sold shares or didn't sell shares, they're going to give me a distribution, if it was a good year, of a tax gain that I have to pay on my return this year. Well, with ETFs, if I sold an ETF versus a mutual fund, I'm not affected by that sale or anyone else's sale. So let me explain. So if in an ETF, shareholders only pay taxes for a turnover within the fund, so the ETF doesn't sell any stock. They actually, instead, they offer shareholders what's called an in-kind redemption. And so it doesn't trigger your tax. Now, what Richard also said, though, was if I'm going to sell my shares and I want to sell them and there's going to be a capital gains, it's like my capital gains would have built up in that fund for a long time, then I will get a personal 1099, but it's not going to affect all the other ETF holders. So that's a big difference. And so I'm glad Richard called us directly and asked us to explain that. Bruce?
Yeah, that's excellent, Peg. I'm going to just simplify it even a little bit more for some people. So most of you listening right now, your method of investing in stocks, if you do, is probably your company 401k plan. So you have experience with mutual funds and maybe even ETFs. Most people that invest in the market, Peg, we always talk about investing in stocks, and I think sometimes people are confused and they think, well, I don't own any individual stocks. Well, you do within your funds. And a fund, you know, if you compare that to buying individual stocks, one of the disadvantages is you might have some increased cost because you're paying someone to make those investment decisions on your behalf, but you're also getting diversification and professional management. And so for a lot of people, that's an appropriate way to go about investing in stocks. So when you and I talk about investing in the market, we don't always mean for everybody buying individual stocks. It might be funds. And I think everybody listening does understand that investing in the stock market or in the bond market does involve risk of principal. Sometimes these investments can retract or go down in value in the short term. Historically, stocks long term have given investors robust returns, good rewards, but not without risk, not without volatility, and you need to understand that. And I think most people do, and most people have experience with funds in their 401k plan. But then, Peg, when you explain ETFs so well like you did, it might beg the question, why don't we always use all ETFs? And what I tell clients is, number one, I like to see a long, and I think our investment management team likes to see a long track record. Not that past performance will guarantee the future, but we like to look at some history, and ETFs are comparatively new, and also because they're new, there's not as many of them out there, and we can't always create the diversification in the portfolio that we want using only ETFs. But at Wealth Enhancement, we do have portfolios that are just ETFs. We do have portfolios that are just traditional no-load mutual funds. We do have portfolios that are just individual stocks and everything in between. We can mix and match. So there's a lot of different ways that we can go about this depending upon what is the best fit for the client. So I'm glad you revisited that. And again, I think that really helps add clarity for listeners. And it's a good segue. So our topic today is about saving and investing and starting early. Mutual funds or ETFs might be one of those things that you choose to invest in. But, Peg, I think people maybe don't understand that starting and creating this habit, to me, it's like exercise or it's like brushing your teeth every day, committing to saving and investing early in life. And doing it consistently is really one of the single best things that you can do to achieve the financial success or achieve the retirement that you want. And it can be hard, though, right? Because our brains, the way our brains actually work, we prioritize. It's just human nature. We prioritize today's fun or today's rewards or today's new shoes or whatever it is that we want, we place a high, our brain places a higher priority on that than our future retirement or our future happiness. It's just the way the brains work. So part of what we're going to talk about today is how we do this, how we trick our brain, how we form some habits to start saving and investing early and doing it consistently. Peg?
Yeah, I think it is when you're young, you know, you just feel like you've got so much time. But yet we don't understand when we're that young the power of compounding. And, you know, the quote here in our outline is, you know, Einstein was said to define this compounded interest as the eighth wonder of the world. And I would agree, whether he did it or said that or not, I would agree. It's just if you start early, and often on this show, we talk about, you know, our youth and when you're young and what you should be doing. But you mentioned, Bruce, there's just so many things that are pulling you in all these different directions when you're young. But I often talk about this compounding interest, and I talk about a snowball going downhill. And a caller called in and said, why is Peg talking about the Rockefeller effect? Well, that to me, that is when a snowball is coming down the hill. It's the same thing as compounding interest. It's getting bigger all the time. That snowball is just happening. And you don't actually have to do anything per se, right? You don't have to go to work. You don't have to, you have to invest money, but yet it's not physical work. It's just something that you have to start. Now, another thing is that it takes patience to do that. First of all, to get started, we talk a lot about habits. And to get started, you have to have the power of patience to save. And if you have anybody that would encourage you to, I mean, even if it's a small amount of money, it doesn't take that long, to double. And we didn't put this in our outline, Bruce, but we talk about this rule of 72. So if you earn 7.2%, it's going to double in 10 years. It's just a simple formula. And I think it's very motivational to see a formula like that to say, oh, that's not that far out, 10 years. And if I earn 7.2%, that's the rule of 72. You can't say, oh, I'm investing for retirement at 65 when you're 25 or 35, because you say, oh, I've got so much time that I can just put that out there. But the power of compounding is to me the eighth wonder of the world, like Einstein said. Bruce?
Well, and the key, Peg, is starting as soon as you can. And I'm stealing a quote from somebody else, but investing is like planting a tree. The best time to do it was 20 years ago, but the second best time is right now. And I still use an example. I put an example in my book, Real Wealth, that I wrote over a decade ago. I tell the story of Jack and Jill. Jill is an overachiever. They're twins, but Jill is, has a very good career very early in life. And at age 21, in this hypothetical example, Jill starts to put $5,000 a year into a Roth IRA. She does it for 10 years, and then she becomes so successful and is making so much money that she can't put money in Roths anymore. There's an income restriction on Roths. So she puts in $5,000 for 10 years for a total of $50,000. And her account earns a hypothetical 8% per year. Now, in the real world, of course, if you're investing in stocks, you will not get a consistent, 8% every year. Some years might be a lot higher. Some years might be lower. Some years it might even be negative. Markets can go down. But it is not unrealistic to assume that you can average 8% per year. In fact, I would tell you that I think we would actually do much better than that over a long period of time at Wealth Enhancement Group. But I chose what I thought at the time when I wrote the book, a conservative 8% per year. Jill doesn't make any more contributions from her early 30s. She does it for 10 years, and then she's done contributing. So her total contributions are $50,000, and she makes a hypothetical 8% every year. Her brother Jack, a little bit of a late starter, late bloomer, he starts investing in a Roth, also $5,000 a year, also makes a hypothetical 8% every year. He starts when Jill stops. He starts in his early 30s, and he invests for 35 years until he's 65 years old. So in total, Jack contributes $175,000 to Jill's $50,000. So Jack puts in $125,000 more than Jill does. He earns the same 8% as Jill, but because Jill starts 10 years sooner than Jack, Jill's account, her Roth IRA at age 65, is worth $1,156,000 and some change. Jack's is only $930,000, or literally $226,000 less than Jill's. And I still use this analogy, Peg, even though I wrote this over a decade ago, because to me it really magnifies the point that to start as soon as you can. And you mentioned it may seem like not that much money. You know, even if it's $100 a month, it makes a difference if you do it consistently and you start early and do it over a long period of time, you apply earnings to it, that number becomes a lot bigger than you might think it will. And that you're right, that is motivating. If people can see actually the difference it can make in their lives, I think that's one of the ways we can override our brain's tendency to want to live more for today. And you talk about it all the time, ways to hide money from yourself, or I might say pay yourself first. They mean the same thing. Peg?
Yeah, I just thought of something, Bruce, when you were telling the Jack and Jill story, which is a great story. But we just told the story and people are going to just forget, right? A day later, here's an idea. And I'm just coming, this is off the cuff here. You know, we easily spend $500 for dining out, or which is getting very expensive, and entertainment for ourselves. And we're not, when we spend that money, let's say we have a $500 weekend. That sounds kind of high, but let's use it as an example. And you went to a concert and you had some dinner before, but you're not thinking about, if I took that $500 and I compounded it for 20 years or 30 years of time, what that would be. What if the credit card companies would put on, when you were paying for all that, would say, here's what you would have compounded for the future. I mean, with technology and all of that, because we need something to remind ourselves every day. And so that was just an idea off the cuff. If they just said, you're going to have $1 million in 30 years if you don't spend this 500, you know, something like that. So it's hard to get people to follow habits, and maybe that would help, maybe it wouldn't, but why don't people do it? Because they're thinking, you know, it's hard to think about longevity and how long you're going to live. But another reason is people fear losses. So if you do start to invest, you know that the markets go up and down if you're in something like the stock market. But yet historically, it has helped people with their financial future. And the big one is inflation. How do you keep up with the costs of tomorrow, especially when you're working towards retirement one day, if you don't invest in something and have the compounding feature that we all have to be able to keep up with inflation? So I like what you said, Bruce, again, just as a reminder, we have to hide money from ourselves. And the best way to do it is really through your company plan. People don't miss that. When you get that automatic deposit in your checking account and those are your net dollars, you're not even thinking about that 401k or that 403b that is compounding. But then you do have to think about, is that even enough? And try to get yourself motivated to save even more. Bruce?
Yeah, some of the other excuses I hear, you know, I hear people, Peg, say, yeah, I know I should do this, but I can't afford it right now. I'll do it when I get my next raise or I have more discretionary money. Or I hear that I'm worried about the market right now. Or I just hear, you know, I just can't afford it. I'm living paycheck to paycheck. So let's talk about the last one I just said, living paycheck to paycheck. I recognize that for some people that might be true. But Peg, the number of times in my 40-plus year career where someone has told me they can't afford it, and then we dig in and we find inefficiencies in their financial world. Maybe we find a way to reduce their taxes. Maybe we find a way to reduce their insurance costs. Maybe they just identify some things that they're wasting money on that they really don't want or need. If we give that capital back to them, that now they can invest that or save that, and they're not sacrificing lifestyle to do it. I think that's the big thing. People don't want to give up lifestyle today for tomorrow, but if we can find money that didn't exist before, and oftentimes we can, then it's easier to save and invest. The objection that the market's risky right now, remember, this is long term. This is not short term. The market might seem volatile or high or low right now, but over time, stocks have proven to reward investors historically, and I think that will always be true. And the idea that I'll do it when I start making more money, for most people, that's an excuse or an alibi. Again, I understand some people literally are paycheck to paycheck, but every time I hear that, it's not always true once we dig in a little bit. So, Susie, I know we're getting close to the end of the first segment. When we come back, we'll tie a bow on the topic, and we'll definitely get listeners involved.
All right, very good. It is time to take our first break, as Bruce mentioned. And if you are listening, you can call 651-461-9226. That's 651-461-9226. We already have a number of questions coming in, so we'll get to as many of your questions as we can on the second half of the program. But again, I'll say it again, the studio line, 651-461-9226. We're back after this short break. And welcome back to the second half of Your Money. I'm Susie Jones, along with Bruce Helmer and Peg Webb, and we're talking about saving early and saving often. And we have questions coming in from people at 651-461-9226. But I'll re-welcome Bruce and Peg to the program before we get to the calls. Bruce, go ahead.
Thank you, Susie Jones. Thank you, listeners. Peg, I know there was a couple things that we wanted to hit on before we go to questions. I'll let you go first, then wrap it up.
Yeah, I just wanted to mention at the end of our outline here, and I think it's really important, is that, you know, you have your financial goals and you have your priority kind of values. And what do I mean by that? So a goal would be, and I've shared this on the radio a lot, is I'm a visionary. So in my head, I'm already picturing what I want when I wanted it. And I'll tell you what it was. I said at the age of 55, yes, I've hit that milestone. At the age of 55, when I was driving to work every day, and it was a good 30, 40 minute drive, I would see people at the end of their driveway having a little table with selling flowers and vegetables and that kind of thing. And driving into work, it just looked so peaceful. And I said, you know what? I want to have enough money accumulated by the age of 55 that I have a choice of being that person who's at the end of the driveway, just do-to-do, you know. So that's what I mean by a visionary. And goals are kind of something that you check off a list. You say, oh, I accomplished that. I accomplished that. But yet you kind of have to have this vision of what the end goal looks like. Values are a little bit different in that it's like your life direction. Like, where are you headed? What's important to you? I found that coaching clients all these years, if I could get out of them what's important to them, then I can guide them with their financial plan better than if they hadn't, you know, shared all of that with me. So I wanted to mention that, Bruce, just kind of the goals and values again, because here we are, we're telling people to save money for the future, but you may want to have a list of your goals and values because that might motivate you more. Bruce?
Peg, that's a great point. And you know, really everything that we do begins and ends with core values, your goals, what are you trying to accomplish and why? And thank you for emphasizing that, because again, sometimes we lose sight of that, and that's really overarching on everything we talk about. And just to emphasize the point, and I've told this story before, but I've had this happen a lot over the years, just as you have, but I have one client in particular that I've shared the story before that, you know, they were on a very quick rise in their career. They kept getting promoted, kept getting salary increases. But they had shared with me that their primary goal was they wanted to fully pay for their kids' education. They didn't want their kids to come out of – they wanted their kids to go to college, and they wanted them to not have student loans, have debt. That was their primary goal. It was very obvious to me, every meeting, every conversation. And I remember one time the client saying to me, hey, I just got another raise, and I think – I'm going to go upgrade my car. I've always wanted a, and I'm not going to say the brand, but a luxury expensive car. And they wanted to know if I thought they could afford it. And I said, well, yeah, I think you can, but I'm not sure you're going to enjoy it. Are you going to, you know, beat yourself up and say, hey, my car payment went from $400 to $800, and that's $400 I could be putting away for my kids' education. Let's not lose sight of what's really important to you. And so they delayed getting the car at that point. Now, in the not-too-distant future, they ended up getting it anyway because he got another raise and another promotion, and we determined they could put as much away for their kids' education as they wanted to and still afford the luxury car. But that reminder of what was really important to them caused him to pause and delay just a little bit. So we talked in the first half of the show of how our brain tricks us. Our brain prioritizes happiness and enjoyment and gratification today over tomorrow. And if we keep sight of what's really important to us, our core values, what makes us tick, what our goals are, if we really focus on that, I think it's easier to override and trick our brain and to do the things we want. And the other thing, Peg, I sometimes hear people describe it as a choice. I can live for today or I can save for tomorrow. I don't think it's an either or. I think you can do both if you plan for it. You and I like to have fun along the way, right? We had goals about, you know, long-term where we wanted to be at a certain age, but that didn't prevent us from enjoying nice dinners out or traveling or whatever. You can do both if you plan for it. I think most people, it's not an either or. Anything else you want to add, or should we throw it to Susie for questions?
Let's throw it to Susie.
Okay, very good. I'll jump in here. We have a texter. My husband is in his 70s and receiving money from a non-taxable personal injury lawsuit. What is the best thing to do with this kind of money to prevent the government from taking it all? I've heard bad stories about this. We do not own a home. Any ideas?
So, Peg, if it was a settlement from a lawsuit or personal, you know, injury accident, I think the texter even says in the text, there's not tax on that money, but I think they're saying, now, what do we do with that money? They say to keep it from the government. I assume that they mean taxes. So there's certain investments they can put that money in where there is going to be tax consequence, but there's others where there might not be. But the settlement itself is not subjected to taxes, right, Peg?
Right. Well, they would have worked with an attorney, I'm sure, to get the personal injury dollar amount. But what I was thinking of is, number one, there was some type of personal injury. So that's the first thing I would look at is how do I invest that? Not necessarily thinking about the government first, but putting money away if it's needed because of this accident or whatever happened. The thing that I was thinking about is, you know, if you don't want to pay the government, I don't know what tax bracket you're in, but municipal bonds are usually tax-free. And so if you invested in those, you wouldn't get a 1099, you know, at the end of the year for the interest. The negative about that, though, is that municipal bonds pay less than, let's say, a treasury bond. And so you have to look at your tax bracket to see if municipal bonds are better than treasuries. My overall advice would be to diversify. And if you're 70 years old, you may still have, you know, 20 years or more. So you have to develop a portfolio that maybe you keep a third in super safe. Maybe it's in the bank. Yes, you're going to get a 1099 because they're paying you interest, but you want to get that interest. And then the second third would be in something that's a little bit more liquid, but you're willing to go five years or so out. Maybe that's a five-year treasury. But then you still have another third that you could say, this is for my long-term. What if I do live to 95 years old? I still have to make money on my money. And you could shelter those taxes by way of maybe purchasing an annuity or an insurance company product, something like that. I highly recommend that you get professional advice, because this is a big deal. This is new money, and you need to investigate, you know, all your options and get with somebody that you trust their advice. Bruce?
Yeah, my brain went to the same place as yours. You know, the first thing I think about, the texter's husband, you know, how's the health? What's the quality of life? How much of this money are they going to need for lifestyle? They're not homeowners. You know, so there's a lot of things we don't know. And Peg, that was an excellent answer. The only thing I'm going to add is, you know, I think people sometimes get so focused on avoiding taxes. And you can defer the taxes. If you have any earned income, you could still contribute to an individual retirement account. And the earnings, there's no 1099, or you can contribute to a Roth IRA, if you have earned income, which can be completely tax-free. But I think sometimes folks get so, you know, enamored with the idea of avoiding taxes. And yes, true, that reducing taxes is one of the most efficient ways that we can enhance return on investment. But again, sometimes I also tell people, don't let the tax tail wag the investment dog. So if I can have an investment that earns 4% tax-free, or I can have an investment that makes 8% but it's taxable, if I'm in a low tax bracket, my net return, even after I pay the taxes, is higher than the tax-free investment. So it's not what you earn, it's what you keep. But there's sometimes going to be drawbacks. Like you said, you can do muni bonds or muni bond funds or build a muni bond ladder, but those yields are probably going to be lower than other investments that we can make. And what's your tax bracket? So I'm not saying tax-free things don't make sense, but I'm saying it's not the be-all, end-all. And it gets back to what you said. You want to diversify probably. But again, we would need to know a little more about situation and how much they need in the short term versus how much is long-term money and so on. But your answer from 10,000 feet, knowing what we know, was outstanding. I just wanted to add a little bit. Susie?
All right, 651-461-9226. A texter writes, what are the advantages of RMDs, and what is an RMD?
Okay, so the texter is talking about required minimum distribution. Peg, and I wouldn't normally think of that as a question where you would say, what are the advantages? But it could be that they don't understand what it is. So maybe for the texter and for all listeners, let's talk a little bit about required minimum distributions.
Yeah, I was smiling too when they said, what are the advantages of required minimum distribution? I don't have a lot of clients that say, hey, I don't want to take this money out of my tax-deferred account. I want it to compound for more, even decades of time. So the IRS got keen to that and said, okay, we got to make people take some money out of this because, once again, of this Rockefeller effect, and then it would go to the next generation. So required minimum distribution, when you turn 73, that happens to be the age now that you're required to take money out. And there's an IRS table that tells you what percentage you need to take out based on the value of the account at the end of the year. Then you have 12 months to be able to take that money out. Secondly, pretty recent, not like yesterday, but pretty recent, the government said, if you're charitably inclined, you can take your IRA distribution out and give it directly to charity up to $105,000 a year. So you could take your required minimum distribution. You could send 100% of it to charities. I, over the years, have encouraged clients, because I can already tell by their taxes that they're charitably inclined, and they were taking the money out of their checking account, which is technically after-tax dollars. So why not take the money out of the required minimum distribution account and have that money go directly to charity? Because what happens is that distribution disappears off the front page of your tax return, which on the front page of your tax return is when all that ripple effect happens, because you have more income that then triggers more tax, especially if you're getting taxed on Social Security. And I could go on and on about that. But I'm a big believer in, if you're already charitably inclined, to take the money from your required minimum distribution. The other thing is the IRS still kept the 70 and a half age. So if you're not yet 73, but you're 70 and a half, you can also utilize this qualified charitable deduction in that case. Other than that, Bruce, I don't know that there's any great news when they said advantages about the required minimum distribution, especially with our clients. I have to say, they don't really want the money. They take it out and then they either give it to the kids or they invest in something more, but they would wish they didn't have to take it out. Bruce?
That was an excellent answer. I do want to add one wrinkle to it, though, but I'm going to ask you to do me a favor before I do that. In your answer, you mentioned ripple effects. For listeners that might not know, explain what you mean by ripple effects, please.
What I mean is if you have something on the front page of your tax return and you are eliminating or you're adding some type of income, sometimes it's not very clear on the form that if you add those dollars to the front page, you will then hit a bogey, if you will, that you have to pay more tax on your Social Security, you know, your income, or you have to pay more tax on your Medicare Part B that you get in the mail. So there's some things that maybe aren't blatantly obvious when you add that to your tax return, and that's why we encourage people to do maybe a preview before year end of what income they have and if they want to give to charity and that kind of thing before year end. Otherwise, if you wait till January, you can't change anything. Bruce?
Yeah, if you go over the income threshold for Medicare Part B premiums by even a dollar, it's not your premium or your cost for Medicare Part B can go up a lot. So we want to really be careful with that. That was an excellent answer, Peg. The only wrinkle I wanted to add is you're right. Most of our clients really don't want to take distributions from their tax deferred accounts. They only do it because it's mandated by law. But I think prevailing wisdom tells people, don't spend that money till the government makes you with required minimum distributions. But oftentimes, it may be in your best interest to start sooner. If your income from all other sources puts you in a really low tax bracket, maybe 10% or 12% federal tax bracket, we encourage you to take distributions before you have to soak up that low tax bracket under the idea that you're probably never going to pay taxes at a lower rate than what you're in right now anyway. And some people say, well, but I don't need the money for lifestyle. Then we might say, well, let's take a distribution anyway and soak up this low bracket and put the balance in a Roth IRA where it's not going to be subjected to required minimum distributions and it's not going to be taxed in the future when you spend it. Or if it's a legacy asset that goes to kids, they're not going to have taxes on it. So, again, many, many, many people have been coached to believe, don't touch my tax-deferred accounts, my traditional IRAs, my traditional 401ks, until the government mandates it. But for a lot of people, you actually want to start those distributions sooner, because if you're in a low tax bracket, then we're going to coach you to start using that money sooner. Susie?
All right, 651-461-9226. A texter writes, I have $100,000 to invest. I'm looking for a short-term, low-risk option. Do you have any thoughts on that?
So, Peg, short-term and low risk for $100,000.
Well, I'm a huge fan of Treasury bonds. I feel like they're safe. I mean, they're issued by the government. And you do have to pay tax on your Treasury bonds, you know, income. But if you want it to be safe, and right now, let's just talk about the yield curve. So the yield curve is that the shorter that you invest time-wise is higher yield in most cases right now than a 30-year bond and every other bond in between. So if you're just looking for a short time frame and something that is deemed to be secure, then I would look at Treasury bonds. You can also look at money markets, which are more liquid, let's say, than buying a one-year Treasury bond. And let's say you wanted to have the money in 30 days versus 365 days. You could go into a money market, not 100% secure, but it very, very close. It would be a close second to a Treasury bond. So those are two options for a shorter term. Bruce?
I would add to that even a short-term CD. You could do a 90-day or 180-day certificate of deposit, maybe get a little bit more interest. Again, it depends upon how soon you want the money or what you mean by short-term. But I like your answers, Peg, and maybe add CD to that. The one thing that you should not do is put it in the stock market. You know, if you listen to this show with any frequency, you hear Peg and I sing the praises of investing in the stock market. But again, that's for long-term money. That's for money that you don't think you're going to need for a decade or longer. If you're going to need the money in the short term, you have absolutely no business putting that money in stocks. So, yeah, treasuries, high-yield money market, short CDs, those are all good answers that very little or no risk of principal, and you'll get a yield, Peg, this is important, higher than the rate of inflation. So you're actually not losing purchasing power. Inflation right now is running roughly 2.5%, and you can make 4-4.5% right now without taking any risk. Susie, I think we can squeeze in at least one more.
Yeah, I like this one. Does wealth enhancement deal with beginners? Says I only have $5,000 to invest.
Peg?
Well, one of the things that I would say is you definitely can call into Wealth Enhancement Group. That there is no reason not to. And you'll talk to somebody that will then, you know, ask you some questions about what you have, probably recommend that you do get some guidance. What I would say is if you have $5,000, what I encourage people to do and young people to do is put it in something that's long-term if you believe that you're not going to use it in the short term. Or, once again, the same thing that the caller, the texter said about short-term. Where do I get, you know, some great money on my money in the long-term? The other thing we brought up today, Bruce, and I'm glad that you did, is it's not just investing that $5,000 or taking you on as $5,000. You're probably one of those people that Bruce talked about where we could find money. You know, is your life insurance adequate or are you paying too much? Your homeowner's insurance, you know, what are the other things you can do through your employer that would, you know, lower your income tax? Those kinds of things. So absolutely, I would call in and, you know, get some advice from us. Bruce?
Peg, that was a great answer, which is good because I don't have to add to it. Susie, I think we're about out of time.
We are out of time, but for anyone who did not get their questions answered, you can email your question to yourmoney@wealthenhancement.com, or you can certainly call the office directly at 1-888-6-ADVICE. Again, that's 1-888-6-ADVICE. Make it a great week.